Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Sharon Jackson as she reports on a rise in gas prices over the past 2 weeks. Jill Sheridan talks about a $12 million budget for substance abuse programs in central Indiana. And regionally speaking, host Chris Nolte talks about Ivy Tech Community College's new 5-year strategic plan. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Average retail gasoline prices in Northwest Indiana have risen just over 2 cents per gallon. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
In the past week, averaging $2.50 a gallon Sunday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 314 gas outlets in the region. This compares with the national average that has increased 3 cents per gallon in the last week to $2.57 per gallon, according to gasoline price website, GasBuddy.com. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy, said as of Tuesday, gasoline prices were looking good for the consumer, but consumers shouldn't get too excited.
Gas prices in at least Northwest Indiana have started to come back down a little bit. I wouldn't draw too much attention to it. In the last week, Northwest Indiana is down by about 9 cents a gallon. Looking at some of the other prices around the area, we're seeing similar declines, at least for the time being.
DeHaan says in the very short term, prices will stay low, but they will move up eventually.
Oil prices took a nice big drop of $1 a barrel today, which may at least help with falling gas prices over the next few days, but don't get too excited just yet. So I would say in the short term, gas prices will probably keep inching down for the next few days before we perhaps see another one of our infamous price hikes, at least later this week or early next.
Including the change in gas prices in Northwest Indiana during the past week, prices Sunday were almost 38 cents per gallon higher than the same day 1 year ago and are unchanged versus a month ago. The national average has increased almost 9 cents per gallon during the last month and stands at just under 31 cents per gallon than this day 1 year ago. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A bill to expand opioid treatment center options in Indiana passed the House this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the proposal would add 9 treatment programs in the state.
Indiana currently has 18 opioid treatment center options, and this bill would increase that number to 27. Bill author Representative Cindy Kirchhoffer says the centers would be approved to operate at local hospitals that apply.
So not only will you have the opioid treatment program, but you'll have the benefit of having a hospital treatment team to provide other supportive services.
Kirchhoffer says this will allow for more comprehensive wraparound services like medical treatment and counseling. The bill would also open some credentialing avenues for mental health providers to treat people in recovery. The legislation now goes to the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Cannabidiol, oil, or CBD, would become legal for anyone in the state of Indiana under legislation unanimously approved by the full House. There are several bills dealing with the issue this session in both chambers. The measure approved Tuesday, January 30th, takes the simplest approach. It defines CBD as a byproduct of the cannabis plant that contains no more than 0.3% of THC, a psychoactive ingredient, and it legalizes CBD. Republican Representative Bill Friend, the measure's author, says cannabidiol oil should be treated like a herbal supplement.
I wake up in the morning without pain now. For me, it's worked. I did not want to be thrown in jail for CBD.
Republican Representative Chris Judy says he has plantar fasciitis, a painful foot condition. And on the House floor, Judy admitted he's used CBD since August.
CBD oil has a negligible amount of THC and does not produce a high or intoxication or euphoria.
The House voted 93-0 to advance the bill to the Senate. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Schools in central Indiana have access to $12 million for substance abuse prevention programs. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the Fairbanks Foundation funding will support programs that get proven results.
High school-age students who receive proven prevention education are more than 60% less likely to use hard drugs like heroin or cocaine. A new grant initiative will provide more of these opportunities. Claire Fidian Green, president at the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation in Indianapolis, says the organization developed this goal in response to the state's opioid epidemic.
We couldn't help asking ourselves, you know, what if we could prevent people from becoming addicted in the first place?
Schools and other student organizations can apply for the non-competitive planning grants to select program opportunities that suit their students' needs. Green says many evidence-based programs have shown reduced risk and added benefits
on their academic performance, their classroom behavior, and discipline in the school.
Planning grants will be awarded in March and implementation would start in May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Student safety was a major focus of the House Education Committee Monday, January 29th. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports, lawmakers approved a set of bills centered around bullying and human trafficking.
Representative Wendy McNamara says human trafficking is a problem even in Indiana, but not all teachers know the signs to identify students who might be at risk.
I'm in my 24th year of education, and I had not really understood or known or been educated about human trafficking until I actually came up here.
Her bill would require the State Department of Education to include links on its website about human trafficking. Teachers would also receive more training to learn the warning signs. Some at the bill's hearing voiced concerns about adding even more time to required teacher trainings, but McNamara says it would be worth it.
I don't think, in my opinion, giving up another hour of my life to save the life of a kid, a seven-year-old, from being human trafficked is too much of an ask.
The bill will now go to the House for consideration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. After hearing testimony last week, Senate lawmakers Wednesday, January 31st, made significant changes to a bill that would have resulted in more people facing termination of their parental rights. Side Effects Public Media's Emily Foreman reports.
The bill would have created a three-strikes rule for parents with child welfare cases. It specified a list of actions from missing a hearing to failing a drug screen. After three violations, the Department of Child Services would have had to ask courts to sever parental rights. After testimony from detractors who said the bill would have been tough on parents suffering from addiction, lawmakers stripped the three strikes rule from the bill. Tammy Wadlington spent 3 years in foster care growing up. She said she appreciated the bill's intention to move more foster children into permanent homes, but she'd like to see birth parents offered treatment rather than punishment.
So please bear in mind that you are going to have very, very good, loving parents who are in very tough situations.
Now, the amended law's only provision is that parents' progress reports are shared with attorneys and court-appointed child advocates 48 hours before hearings. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Emily Foreman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. The Indiana Senate approved legislation Tuesday, January 30th, to require doctors and clinics to send more information to the state about women who receive abortions. One provision of the bill details abortion complications that must be reported. That includes conditions ranging from blood clots and cardiac arrest to depression and anxiety. The measure also adds new details about women to reports sent to the state following an abortion. Current law requires information such as age of the women, date of the abortion, and age of the father. That bill adds details that include the woman's race, ethnicity, and the number of her deceased children. Democratic Senator Jean Brough says some of the new details make no sense.
The marital status of the patient, why does that matter? The educational level of the patient, why does that matter?
But Republican Senator Liz Brown argues the information is necessary to help the state protect women.
Hopefully it'll give women the information they need, but we are not putting up any obstructions as much as I wish that we could.
The Senate approved the bill 38-11, sending it to the House. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talks with Richard DeBoer, Executive Vice President for Ozinga, on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Here's that conversation.
Well, good morning and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Today our guest is Mr. Richard DeBoer. He's the Executive Vice President for Ozinga. Rich, good morning and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, you know, Rich, a lot of people associate Ozinga just with concrete, but you're in the alternative fuel business as well. Tell our listeners a little bit about Ozinga.
Yes, Ozinga is well known for our ready-mix concrete business. The red and white striped trucks are a common sight out on the highways and here in the community. Ozinga started out in 1928 as a coal and building materials provider, and this year, 2018, marks our 90th year as a family-owned and operated business.
Wow. Congratulations.
In 2011, we entered into the alternative energy business as well as Ozinga Energy. And Ozinga Energy builds, owns, and operates compressed natural gas filling stations for our own use and the general public's use, as well as other fleets. Basically, a full-service provider for anything compressed natural gas related.
So I know you've made a commitment to compressed natural gas in your own fleet. I know South Shore Clean Cities has worked with Ozinga on some grant funding for that. Tell us about your compressed natural gas fleet, Rich.
Well, in 2011, we started with our first compressed natural gas fuel ready mix concrete truck. Today, we're operating over 170 compressed natural gas mixer trucks and about 45 support vehicles, which are our cars, pickup trucks, sales vehicles, SUVs, that type of equipment. We operate five of our own compressed natural gas fueling stations, and we've built and maintained stations for probably five of our own and over 20 stations for others in Illinois, Indiana, and across the country. We're members of the South Shore Clean Cities organization, and that's been a real good source for networking and keeping up with the latest in alternative fuels opportunities.
So I know you're helping a lot of groups adopt to compressed natural gas in their fleets as well, including the City of Hobart. And tell us about the project with the City of Hobart.
Yes, we were fortunate to win the bid to build Hobart's new CNG station, which we just completed here in December of 2017. The citizens of Hobart are the real beneficiaries here of that CNG project. Their mayor and Public Works Department have been working hard for over 2 years trying to bring this into existence. And now they enjoy a low-cost fuel with near-zero emissions and reduced noise due to the operation of these vehicles. The town will really benefit from that, from financially as well as from a mission standpoint and a noise factor.
Well, I know that the mayor and the City of Hobart have been one of those model groups here in Northwest Indiana that have been really easy to work with. They've been a sponge, similar to Ozinga in regards to, trying to be a leader in reduce emissions and help reduce our dependence on imported oil. And we're really proud to have partnered not only with Ozinga, but with the City of Hobart on bringing this. And, we're starting to see, Rich, as a lot of the different organizations across the country, we're starting to get a lot of notoriety from a lot of the work that Ozinga has been involved with compressed natural gas. And again, with the number of vehicles that you have already retrofitted or replaced with natural gas is just amazing. So what else does Ozinga have planned for 2018?
Well, we are continuing to build additional stations and for our own use and for others across the country, for other fleets. The fleets are easy adapters to this, fuel simply because of the leave from and return to the same point of origin each day so they can produce their own fuel and utilize that on a daily basis and not be concerned with infrastructure issues that might arise if you're going long distances.
No, very exciting information, Rich. Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program?
No, we firmly believe that the compressed natural gas as an alternative fuel is a good answer to our country's energy policy. And it's a fuel that's found readily available here, right in the United States. It's not dependent on any foreign entities, and it benefits every citizen here in the country.
Well, congratulations on your 90th anniversary, and that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again to our guest, Mr. Richard DeBoer. He's the Executive Vice President for Ozinga. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Be sure to tune in and to visit us online at southshorecleancities.org. And thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra.
John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Donna Catalano with South Shore Arts. Here's that conversation.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Donna Catalano, my co-worker at South Shore Arts. Donna, you are in charge of our grant program and through our regional arts partnership with the Indiana Arts Commission. And you've been doing this for quite a number of years.
Actually, 10 years, and it was in September.
10 years.
Yes.
10 years plus.
Yes.
And so this a grant program whereby South Shore Arts distributes money. This is state allotted money from the General Assembly through the Indiana Arts Commission and then trickling on down through us for Lake Porter and LaPorte counties for organizations, nonprofit organizations, either arts organizations or other kinds of nonprofits that are interested in receiving funding for arts projects.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And
take it away.
The funding actually originates with the National Endowment of the Arts, which gives every state money based on per capita. And then the state is required to match that and then distribute it through all the state. And so since Indiana has 92 counties, we are Region 1, which is Lake Porter and LaPorte counties. And outside of Indianapolis, we have the most dense population. So we have the second largest amount of grant money to give away. Last year, we gave away over $250,000 in grant money. And so we're excited about this new year. Last year, we had 40 grantees, and we're looking to do the same this year, probably. As you mentioned, there are arts projects support funding, which goes up to, they can receive up to $5,000 for a non-arts organization that does arts projects. So we have several of those. We have like the Dunes Learning Center does art camp in the summer. Boys and Girls Clubs have art programming that we help with. There's a dance company in East Chicago, folklore dancing with Deborah Bolaños in East Chicago. So we do a lot of like fun things with municipalities, other schools, just people that do good things.
Well, we should say that even Eye on the Arts is supported.
Yes, it is.
Through a grant that is submitted every year by Lakeshore Public Media and both the TV and I assume our radio interviews are also covered by that application.
Mm-hmm.
So, so it's a wide range of projects whereby the arts are used to help enrich people's lives.
Right. And the project grants are for projects whose organization has a budget of an income budget averaged over 3 years of under $50,000. Mm-hmm. After $50,000 and you have arts in your mission statement, you would go up to an arts organization grant, and there's two levels in that. $50,000 to $250,000 is AOS art organization support one, and then if you after $250,000 you go up to a higher level, mm-hmm. and you can ask for up to $20,000 in funding. Mm-hmm. And we have like five or six of those, mm-hmm. so we're very fortunate. We don't realize sometimes how common and good arts are in this region.
Right, how they proliferate.
Yes, and they're a great economic driver.
Absolutely. So some of the larger organizations in our region include the Lebesnik Center in Michigan City.
Yes.
Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, mm-hmm. Theater at the Center in Munster. Yep.
Chicago Street Theater.
Chicago Street Theater is
yes,
on that level
absolutely.
Now.
And then LaPorte County Symphony.
Okay.
And Gloria Tuohy and Indiana Ballet.
Okay. So those five that we fund. Mm-hmm. And then South Shore Arts itself, mm-hmm. Which is funded directly by the Indiana Arts Commission.
Yes.
So and then we have numerous organizations through all three counties in the AOS 1 level as well. This partnership began, it came out of a strategic planning cycle that the Indiana Arts Commission executed back in the mid-90s. They were criticized justifiably for focusing so much of their money on Indianapolis, the collar counties, maybe a little bit down in Brown County and mm-hmm. Bloomington. And this structure, whereby they identified originally 12 partners throughout the state, helped to distribute the funding more equitably
yes.
based on population.
And we're happy since we get the second most amount of money, so we're very happy in Region 1.
And some of our partner organizations have to have like 16 counties
yes.
in their region.
Just south of us in Lafayette, Tippecanoe Arts Federation, I think she has 14 counties.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some counties with no arts programming. And it's
right.
The rural areas are actually underserved areas.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been targeting those rural areas in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And we've been partnering – Indiana Arts Commission has been partnering with OCRA in trying to get those money out to rural counties.
So the deadline is March 1st.
March 1st is the deadline.
The system
is online.
Yep.
Anybody can email me. You can go on our homepage, on our website, on the bottom right corner. You can find all the links you need.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's online. It's very simple.
It is easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's
mm-hmm.
for programs that will take place between July 1st of 2018 and June 30th of 2019.
Yes. And we do panel these grants. We have a panel. We panel them separately. Project supports are separate from the other ones. And then that meets, I think it's the first Saturday in May, we will panel those. You'll get your notification of funding in July, and then hopefully money, they say October, but it's usually December.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks, Donna, for coming in and telling us about the grant opportunity. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Regionally speaking, host Chris Nolte talks about Ivy Tech Community College's new 5-year strategic plan. And we've asked statewide president Sue Elsperman to review it and talk about the impact it will have on Northwest Indiana. The plan aligns with Indiana's goal to give 60% of the Indiana workforce a high-value post-secondary degree or credential by 2025.
Ivy Tech Community College has just launched a 5-year strategic plan. What kind of impact will it have for Northwest Indiana? Well, let's find out from the boss, from Dr. Sue Elsperman, who's with us from her office. Thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today. I know that this is a very, very ambitious goal or set of goals, actually, that you have for Ivy Tech Community College. Will you take a little time first and tell us more about the 5-year strategic plan, how it's come about, and whether it's some of the goals that you're hoping to reach in the next 5 years?
To be clear to many, the state of Indiana is really counting on Ivy Tech. We are the nation's largest singly accredited community college. We cover the entire state. There in Northwest Indiana, we have three significant campuses, the Lake County, Valpo, and Michigan City campuses, all serving well, but we cover the entire state. So as you understand, our employers are needing middle skills workforce with great need out there, and we have been working with the General Assembly trying to line up our programs to make sure that they are those high-wage, high-demand, in-demand jobs. And so we have founded our strategic plan really on two premises. One is the Lumina goal, which the state has adopted, understanding that going forward, more than 60% of our workforce will require post-secondary degrees or credentials and has set that goal for 2025. Half of those, we think, is in this sub-baccalaureate, 2-year and less kinds of degrees and credentials. So if you just make that into an annual number, we picked kind of 50,000 out of that we think is Ivy Tech's portion.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Governor Holcomb, on his State of the State address, talked about 1 million more jobs that will be available across Indiana over the next 10 years, half of those requiring post-secondary degrees and credentials. So again, you have this 50,000 jobs a year that are going to require some post-secondary degree or certification or certificate. So both ways, we understand and have adopted as our vision, our big goal is to get to 50,000 degrees or credentials per year. Today, we are at 21,182. That's a pretty big lift for us as an institution, but one that we have a system that's capable of doing that, particularly if we focus heavily in those high-wage, high-demand areas that our employers are clamoring for, and that will provide the really good jobs for Hoosiers to have prosperous incomes.
In those particular areas, what jobs or types of jobs are you discovering, and of course is going to be part of the overall plan, that you want to either add as far as to the curriculum or that you're already having in the curriculum you're going to try to beef up, so to speak, to be able to meet the demand for the jobs?
Yeah, so that's the really good news is that Ivy Tech has most of the programs that are in those high-wage, high-demand areas, and they include things like industrial maintenance, and you have programs there like Steel Workers for the Future, and that all we have the programs in technology like IT, in healthcare like nursing. So we have welding in certainly in high-demand across all of our manufacturing employers and building trades, and of course building trades are growing. So we have the programs. We don't have enough, quite honestly, enough students walking in the door right now to come into those programs. So we are shifting our strategy significantly to really deliberately recruit into those programs, and we welcome our employers to help us do that as well so that we can attract not only the 18-year-olds, but many more adults out there. So you may know that we have over 700,000 Hoosiers across our state with some college but no degree. We'd love to help those get to a meaningful degree or credential. And then we have well over a million that have no college at all that are in their middle career years and would be able and very capable of taking on these middle skills jobs if they came back and got that. Anything from a six-month kind of commitment to get a meaningful certificate up to the full associate degree with a two-year degree. So we really encourage those that are out there. The governor rolled out his next-level jobs, which actually makes it free for people to come back, adults to come back into these high-wage, high-demand jobs. And if your listeners want to get on nextleveljobs.org, they can find directly what the long list of these, what are called four-flame and five-flame jobs are, very hot, if you will, jobs for the state of Indiana. So that's very exciting. We have those programs. We want to recruit more students in, and we'll continue campus by campus to make sure that we have exactly those programs that are needed for the employers in that service area. And in fact, that was part of our restructure this year, is to really make sure that each of our campuses have the autonomy that's needed and can focus on those jobs. So that's the big goal. Mm-hmm. But then within it, it's absolutely about helping to, as we talked about enrollment, enrolling those numbers of students that we need in order to have that 50,000 completions each year to meet the workforce needs. And so we're very excited to roll this out across the state.
We're talking with Dr. Sue Elsperman, who is the statewide president of Ivy Tech Community College, and talking about the new five-year strategic plan that is going to not only help the college statewide, but here in Northwest Indiana, to be able to make itself available for those people, adults as well as young people, who are interested in the jobs of the future as they develop, and the ones, some of the ones that are out there already. Dr. Elsperman, in talking with the folks up here in Northwest Indiana, and I know you were up here recently for one of the board meetings that was held in Michigan City. Did they spend any time talking with you about, more specifically, about their opportunities that are available for people to work in Northwest Indiana, and knowing that we can, as looking for the experience and the educational opportunities as well, that Ivy Tech Community College can jump in and fill the gap, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. I know you have some amazing employers in Northwest Indiana, the big employers like BP and ArcelorMittal and Praxis Air, there's so many good employers that are there, and we want to serve all, from the small ones to the large ones, and boy, healthcare, the needs in our healthcare systems to, as we baby boomers age here, we need ever more of those employees, from medical assisting to surge techs, et cetera. So we have, yes, we've got a great regional board there that is doing good work, and our task is to have those campuses in Northwest Indiana, those three campuses, really meet the needs of each of their immediate communities, but collectively cover the needs of Northwest Indiana. I may mention that one of our interesting metrics going forward that I don't think you'll see any other two-year or four-year college in Indiana or the Midwest measure themselves on are actual wages of our students when they complete. Mm-hmm. So our commitment is not just to help a student get to that degree or completion, but to ensure that they're successfully and that they have a job that offers prosperity. So we've begun measuring our graduates. We know today that 38% of our graduates 1 year out are making more than the median income in Indiana. We want to bump that number up to 80% over the next 5 years, so that we, if we are truly lining up our programs to those that employers, those many great employers you have in the area, then these individuals will come out making those wages. You've probably seen the billboards in Northwest Indiana for ArcelorMittal on what a steel worker makes today, you know, that $90,000 or $95,000 a year. So those are incredible wages and incomes for families to prosper, and we want to ensure that every case we're helping to direct our students into those kind of programs that will offer the employers the workforce they need, but our students the kinds of futures that they seek as well.
I know you talk about the Steelworker of the Future program that's underway. That's an interesting program that has been going on for quite some time here, and I know that that Ivy Tech Community College has been working very closely with ArcelorMittal, and I'm sure the other steel companies in the region, or if they haven't, they will be, I'm sure, to offer something similar at their facilities as well. And they probably found that this has been a very successful program.
It is, and again, as I have the opportunity to speak to your many listeners, we would encourage many more of both our 18-year-olds and young adults that are out there who want to look for that ever greater career opportunity, that yes, we have an amazing steelmaking industry there in Northwest Indiana, but we have amazing employers in those areas like industrial maintenance and welding, and the tech areas are so ripe to ensure that we can help fill important jobs and help our Hoosiers move into great incomes as well.
Well, Dr. Ellsperman, it sounds like that the Ivy Tech Community College, with the basis for this 5-year strategic plan well underway and working on getting the regions off and running as well, too, that you're off to a good start for being able to reach the goals that you've set, certainly, and the goals that Governor Holcomb has put forth here, and wanting to be sure that not only have all the jobs in Indiana that can be had, but also the opportunities for people to go to work in those jobs. Thank you very much for spending time to give us an update on the strategic plan and how things are pertaining here in Northwest Indiana.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
We're talking with Dr. Sue Ellsperman, who is the statewide president of Ivy Tech Community College. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.